My name's Scott. I'm an alcoholic. Hi, everybody. I'd like to thank Mark. You know, sometimes you get introduced at an AA function. It's kind of like getting buried by a priest you don't know. You know, who has to just kind of confer with the family real quickly before they say a few words over you. And Mark's great. I've really had a good time with him since I got to town. It's great to be in Kansas. It's a great honor to be asked to do anything in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's a great honor to be asked to make coffee in Alcoholics Anonymous, be a greeter, be a host. I'd like to thank the committee for having me out and all the people involved in organizing this function. I'm from Sherman Oaks, California, at the epicenter, a couple of miles from the epicenter. It's a pleasure to be out in Kansas. I hear you're faultless. So it's a pleasure for me to be here. Can I see the hands of people in their first year? All right. I have a great life today. I'm sure that thrills the crap out of you if you're in your first year. I know how pleased I was for the people having a good life in Alcoholics Anonymous when I got here. I was so excited for them. I'd sit and I'd listen, you know. I'd sit in my chair and listen and about the new house and the job, and I'd sit and I'd go, geez, wouldn't it be terrible if you went home to the new house and it blew up, you know, and your family blew up and you blew up. Wouldn't that be awful? So if you're new here and if you're in your first year and you're anything like me, you might be sitting and looking around this room tonight and saying to yourself, Alcoholics Anonymous, how lame is this? How did I wind up in Alcoholics Anonymous? This is beyond lame. This is beyond church, beyond synagogue. This is a plateau of lameness I never imagined was available to me. Alcoholics Anonymous. Welcome. Yeah, you're with the lames now. If you're new here, you are now privy to an unsolicited reservoir of information and advice. They're going to talk some long stuff to you. And if you're anything like me, you'll grin and you'll nod and you'll pray that their face will burst into flame. Right? I mean, man, I am here. I'm here in Alcoholics Anonymous. My life's over. Isn't that bad enough that I'm here? No, I got to listen to these. They get right up in your face. They usually have one tooth with a cavity in it, you know. Do I want what you've got? I think not. It's insult to injury, man. I'm here in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's so great being here for a bunch of reasons. I get to hang out with some of my friends from Kansas and Nebraska. And these are people who, when I see them, I know I'm in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. These are people who I'm relieved when I see them. And I'm relieved when I see the people that they sponsor, because I know that these people approach the program of Alcoholics Anonymous the same way it's been given to me. You know? And what happens is when our program stops becoming about alcoholism, it all of a sudden can become a program that seems to be about issues and boundaries and not about alcoholism. I'm not saying that I don't have issues and boundaries, but I have alcoholism, and that I got to stay really focused on that. And these days it can get kind of diffuse. And when I see people and associate with people who approach the program on that level, it's a tremendous joy to me. It's a great relief. If you're bored here tonight, I like to tell you my favorite story about being bored in Alcoholics Anonymous. It happened to a guy in my home group, and I heard it when I was new, and I'll never forget it. It was just the greatest thing I ever heard about being bored in AA. This guy named Jeff D., he was brand new, and he was shifting around in his seat, and his sponsor said, "What's the matter?" And he said, "I'm bored." And his sponsor said, "Well, you know why you're bored." And Jeff said, "No." And his sponsor said, "You're bored because you're boring. That's why you're bored." And Jeff, it was like an acid moment for him. He went, wow. It was like, it was heavy, you know. It was, it really blew him away. He thought, man, what a cool thing to say to a newcomer. He could hardly wait till a newcomer told him that they were bored, you know. 13 years later, he's got 13 years of sobriety. Nobody has told this cat that they're bored. He's at a meeting, 13 years sober. This young lady, she's new. She's there at the meeting with him. She's shifting around in her seat, and he says, what's the matter? She says, I'm bored. He says, well, you know why you're bored. She said, yeah, because I'm with you. Right? That's why I'm bored. So if you're new, your time can come, you know? Just have to wait for it. I was brought up in an insane family in the Bronx in New York City. My family was completely out of their minds. My wife never believed me about my family until she met them. My aunt threw an engagement party for us. My mom did, actually, and my aunt came to the party and wore her wig backwards and it had a bun on it. And it wasn't a mistake. It was a look she was going after. She even wore it a little askew, kind of beret style, you know, for a jaunty kind of look. They were absolutely out of their minds. My uncle, if you got something for free in my family, it meant it was stolen. And her husband was a welder, and he used to get these bales of free steel wool. And she took a decorating course and made throw pillows and filled all the throw pillows in the house with the steel wool. Now, after a while, that stuff works its way through on you. So when you went to their house, everybody was moving a little bit. Everybody was up and down and moving. The whole room had a little English on it, you know. And lest you think much has changed, a couple of months ago, my mom called me and said, I got bad news for you. Your Uncle Izzy's dead. Now, this is her brother-in-law. This is a couple of months ago. I said, oh, no, Mom, when did he pass away? A year ago. A year ago? Well, she said, you know, your Aunt Phyllis is back in the mental institution, and she calls me and harasses me, so I haven't been picking up the phone a lot, but Phyllis died a couple of weeks ago, so I started taking phone calls again, and they finally reached me to tell me Izzy's dead. If you're new here, all I have is good news for you, because my family had not one single solitary thing to do with making me an alcoholic. Not one single thing to do with making me an alcoholic. If they did, then I could go to psychotherapy and work out all of these issues and drink like a normal person. I would no longer have to go to parties and say, no, no, no heroin for me, I'll have a Perrier. I wouldn't have to do that anymore. I could drink like a normal person. But no amount of therapy, no amount of work on these family problems will permit me to be anything than what I am, which is an alcoholic, which is a threefold illness. Psychology is onefold. I can't guess you can't cure a threefold illness with onefold. Onefold wouldn't work then, would it? I was brought up in this family in the Bronx, and I set some very lofty goals for myself as a young man when I was growing up in New York City. And by the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had reached or surpassed them all. By the time I got sober, I had a book on the bestseller list. I had acted in a Broadway play. I had directed a movie. I had directed a TV show. I had had my own theater in New York City. I had done all of these things a time. I never got to do any of them more than once. Because when I'd leave, they'd move the business so I couldn't find it again. And the reason why is people were horrible to me. Horrible to me. And when I took, if you're new here, I want to tell you, we do have an alcoholic test. It's called an inventory. And to pass it, all you have to do is do it. It's a pass situation. For other diseases, they have blood tests, they have x-rays, they have all sorts of stuff. We have an inventory. And if you do the inventory, you'll actually see a picture of your illness. I'm resentful at him. I'm resentful at me for resenting him. I'm resentful at them for watching me resent him. Right? And I've had sex with all of them, right? And I'm scared of all of them. All right? How did I get anything done? And if, you know, sometimes guys I work with, they'll do a little bit of inventory and they'll say, can I just, you know, this really feels terrible. Can I come over and just read you what I have? And I would go, no. Why don't you read the whole thing? Can you look at the whole thing? Can you come over and read the whole fetid mess And if you do, if you could do that and look at the whole thing, you just might be so crushed under the weight of it, so deflated of ego at depth that you might be able to stick around here. You might be one of the people who gets crushed so bad that their ears open up. And that's an incredible thing. That's an incredible thing to watch in Alcoholics Anonymous. So I did that inventory. And when I did my inventory, I saw that early on, people were doing things behind my back. And a little later on, they started talking behind my back. And in the last few years, they started thinking behind my back. It's happened to you. And it's terrible. It's hard to catch them. but you can catch them. You can catch them. You got to accuse them of it all the time. And you'll get them. You'll get them. And that's what started happening to me. You know, as I built up these careers and destroyed them, by the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had been in psychotherapy for 18 years. I was on the brink of being a very well-analyzed corpse by the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not putting therapy down. I think it's great stuff. The Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous says on page 133, if you need a doctor, go get one. That is in the family afterward. That's kind of like after all the steps are described. If you need a doctor, go get one. It says in step 5 that no wonder those in the medical profession have such a low opinion of our chances to recovery because we've hardly ever told these helpful people the truth. You know? I was going to have no Oedipal conflict and I was going to be dead by the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. So it doesn't matter to me if you do or you don't. If you do go see a doctor who doesn't understand alcoholism, it's kind of like going to a doctor for a broken leg and having the doctor say, geez, I've always wanted to see one of those. What do you do with it, you know? So I thought this deal of self-knowledge in therapy was going to solve this problem I was having with my careers and my family and with people doing things behind my back, and I kept getting arrested. And I didn't want to be a drunk, and I drank till I didn't want to be a drunk, and I overcame my alcohol problem with marijuana. And I was victorious over marijuana with LSD, and I triumphed over LSD with pills. I kicked pills through the use of a tremendous amount of cocaine. Cocaine's a good drug. It's particularly good for sex if you enjoy sex from the Neolithic period. I was victorious over cocaine with heroin. Heroin's an interesting drug. It starts out kind of artistic and interesting, and then you cross the line and become a vomiting pig. It's this little leap you make, and you don't want to do that too long. So then I would drink until I wanted to be didn't want to be a drunk, and I did not have alcoholism when I got here. And if you're new here and you don't have alcoholism, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. First of all, I've been in psychotherapy for 18 years. Second of all, I was an artist, so I wasn't an alcoholic. I was just an adventurous, dark, interesting person. And I was Jewish also, and I was taught as a kid that Jews don't drink because it might dull the pain. And you don't want that to happen. Don't want to miss out on any agony opportunities. You want to have a clear head for that. Oh, man. So if you're new here and you don't have alcoholism, I'm just telling you, I caught it here at these rooms and these meetings. I did not have alcoholism when I got here. I have a lousy case of alcoholism today, and you gave it to me. Now, if you don't catch alcoholism, you die from it. And if you catch it, you get better. Yeah. You don't go to the doctor and have whooping cough and the doctor go, well, if you can really get whooping cough, we can cure this thing, you know? It's just a very, very bizarre disease. So this is how I traveled through my life, destroying careers, destroying my family. I got arrested on a number of occasions. I sold heroin to a New York City policeman. call me a nut. He wasn't wearing a uniform. I got confused. dropped out of school at the age of 14. I put myself through acting school by working in a hardware store. Potential, man, tremendous potential. All of this potential all the time, you know. And my father passed away when I was a young man. He died of a stroke. I was stoned on heroin the night that he died. And I that's something I would never live down. Certainly never, ever get over. I had track marks. I was a narcotics addict. I was a pig. I couldn't be there for my father, for my mother, for my brother. And that was something I was certainly never going to get over. And I swore that I would never, ever do that again. So I went and drank till I didn't want to be a drunk and took drugs till I didn't want to be a drug addict. And shortly after this, I met a remarkable woman. A woman, I was, from the Bronx, and this woman to me was exotic. She was from Detroit. and she was amazing. I mean, a smart, beautiful, intelligent woman. If you took everything I did in 8 years of marriage and wrote it down in a book, and gave it to this woman, and she read it, and you said, would you live with this? No, she wouldn't live with it. What reasonable human being would live with that? But you spread it out over 8 years, throw in a best-selling book, throw in a Broadway play, throw in chronic success, throw in the fact that when I started the walk to the drink, quite often I was telling the truth. It got a little murky over here. It was quite often an out-and-out lie by the time I got to the drink, but it was quite often the truth when I started out. You know? And yeah, you'd live with it. It'll chip away at you. It'll make you sick and insane, selfish, self-centered, greedy, terrified, a mind reader, you know. And Nancy and I got so sick together. At one point, a guy lent us his car, and we sold his car. I will never forget this man's voice on the phone as long as I live. You sold my car? I lent you the car. How could you sell my car? Many years later, when I called him to make amends, his voice was exactly the same. He said, you're paying me back? he was much more surprised with the second call. And I know I was much more surprised with the second call. I came home one day, we had these big iced tea tumblers, and I popped a cork on a bottle of wine. I emptied the entire bottle of wine into this big tumbler. And I turned around, and I'm getting the rat face. I said, what? And Nancy said to me, what are you doing? And completely seriously, I looked into her eyes, and I said, I'm having a glass of wine. Can't a man have a glass of wine in his own home? We got very, very sick. And we had two children who became very sick from alcoholism. By the time I got sober, our older son was making involuntary clicking noises that he couldn't stop making with his throat. He was diagnosed as functionally retarded in school. He was reading and writing years below his grade level. He was crushed up and terrified from the disease of alcoholism. Fear ought to be classed with stealing. It seems to cause more trouble, and how horribly true for the young people who are exposed to alcoholism. I'm going to take the walk to the drink. No matter what. If you get in between me and the drink, you're either going to become invisible or I'm going to walk around you. You're going to become a papier-mâché figure or you're going to vanish. If you're a kid, how many times can your needs, wants, and desires vanish before you start believing what you're being taught, which is you're invisible. You don't matter. You have no substance. Children have such little ego strength to begin with. But when they're taught that no matter what I say over here, doesn't matter what I say, I'm going to get there, and I'm going to get what I need. And if I got to walk around you, I got to walk bigger and bigger circles because it hurts too much to see any part of you. And this is what happened to our older son and what happened to our younger son, Jesse, and they became progressively sicker and sicker from alcoholism. In the last year I was drinking, we were in our death throes, and the disease of the Al-Anon I have come to appreciate as no less fatal than the disease suffered directly by us. I lost track of the pills I was taking, and I had an idea to cook something. And I went down in the middle of the idea. Nancy came home, and I was laying on the floor holding a frying pan, and the stove was on, and I was toxic and dying. And she called the doctor and said, look, I found this empty vial, and he's got shallow breathing. And the doctor said, call an ambulance. Why have you even called me? And she hung up and called another doctor to get a second opinion. She got a second opinion on a corpse. This is the kind of illness that was pervading our family at that time. 13 years after the fact, I put a needle in my arm again, which I swore I would never do. I called my therapist of record at that time and told him what I had done, and he said, there's absolutely nothing I can do for you. I said, what? He said, there's nothing I can do for you. The only thing I can suggest is you attend a meeting of Narcotics Anonymous, Alcoholics Anonymous, or we have you institutionalized. On most other mornings, I would have gladly chosen the institution. That would have been fine with me. That would have been a chance to meet some more interesting, colorful, dark people, the kinds of people I was interested in, you know, associating with. I mean, in the last few years, I was excited when they told me I needed dental surgery, you know. That's an uninterrupted source of narcotics for a period of time. Normal people don't get excited about dental surgery. Normal people don't go, dental surgery. They'll do almost anything to avoid dental surgery. And yet I got a little, and since I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous, I have met men and women who have submitted to completely unnecessary surgical procedures in order to stay loaded. You don't find that in the Rotary, folks, I'll tell you that. And why I did, I don't know, but I went to my first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. I actually went to one, came home, poured myself a glass of wine, and Nancy said, what are you doing? And I said, honey, these people are civilized. You don't stop drinking completely. You have a glass of wine. They're not maniacs, you know. And a couple of days later, I went to my first real Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. And sat in that room and just looked around and couldn't believe that I was in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm a major guy. What am I doing in Alcoholics Anonymous? I just couldn't believe it. And I went to the 7 a.m. meeting, and I woke up at 5 o'clock in the morning and put on my best clothes and got a bad check to write you. You know, I went to report to AA, you know, you know those new guys. You know, they look like a 7-year-old maid and only part of it works, you know, and they come in and every part of their face is moving in a different direction. I was absolutely out of my mind. I have no idea to this day why I stuck around Alcoholics Anonymous. If you're new here, perhaps it's because I was just out of plans. And if you're new here, I hope you're out of plans. I pray for you that you're out of plans. If you have a plan, it's probably a butte. don't use your plan. Grab one of us after the meeting and tell us the plan. We want to know the plan. That's actually the book I've always wanted to see, the collection of newcomer plans. Mm-hmm. Have a lot of diagrams in it. I stuck around AA for 6 months and was completely out of my mind. I was enjoying the gift of step none. I didn't know I was an alcoholic. I didn't know I was suffering from untreated alcoholism. Untreated alcoholism is particularly unattractive in people who are not drinking. The guys who are drinking are treating their alcoholism. It's a treatment. It works. It kills you, but it works. But those who are not drinking and who are not using the program of action outlined in that book, man, is that ugly. That is a bear. You can pick them out at the meetings real easy. They usually have a vein pumping like a garden hose on their forehead. You know? They're a relaxed and happy lot. I was about 6 months of not drinking, of not doing anything. I was certifiably out of my mind. my wife and the kids had, you know, it's a funny thing. When my older son Michael was born in New York 15 years ago, we had family and friends and flowers and all this activity in the hospital. 2 years and 9 months later, when Jesse was born in Los Angeles, there were no friends, no flowers, no family. It had happened that quick. We were all alone. We were quarantined by the disease of alcoholism, and we didn't even know it. So what happened during this 6 months is we started getting into the community of Alcoholics Anonymous and the Al-Anon family groups, and we started coming back to life a little bit. And the kids started getting a little less scared because at least the money was getting home. So I knew that I was going to have to do something, and I asked a guy to sponsor me, and he took me over to his house that afternoon, and he addressed every problem I have ever had or ever will have that afternoon. He addressed them. He didn't solve them, but he addressed them that day with me. He addressed my resentments against you, my resentments against myself, my unsolvable sexual problems, and my overwhelming fears. Now, you hear some people say, and I know it's true for them, that mostly they resented themselves. And I know that that's absolutely not true for me. I really hated you. I hated you far more than I ever hated me. I mean, I hated me, but I really hated you. I am not a suicide guy. I'm a homicide guy. And I'm not putting the suicide people down. I'm not. I vastly prefer your death to mine. I always have. And that's just where I go. And it's almost kind of the flip side of the same coin in a way, you know. And I don't mean to offend the suicide people. I just, that's where I've always gone. He worked the first three steps with me that day. I said, can I start working with other people? And he said, you got a quarter and a car? I said, yeah. He said, lend him a dime, give him a ride. And you could do that as much as you want, but don't do anything else, you know. And, he gave me instructions in the fourth step, and I did that fourth step. It took me about 3 months. I came over to his house and read that fourth step at about 9 months of sobriety. I did my fifth step. I did six and seven for the first time, and then I sat down to write my amends list out. The best reading of the eighth step I have ever heard in my life took place at my old home group, and I've never seen this guy. I'd never seen him before this night, and I've never seen him since, and I'll never forget him. His name was Nino. He had a heavy New York accent. He had never read Chapter 5 before, and he was there. He had a hospital wristband on. He was there with a hospital group. And he got up. He was reading the Chapter 5, and he was reading the steps, and he got up to Step 8, and he read, made a list of all those we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Jesus Christ! And he looked out into the room as if to say, have you seen this? Do you know what's in here? It was beautiful. It's exactly what happened. That's what happened to me when I saw the steps. It's all that I saw. No, not that money, not those people, not that. I wouldn't have taken that much money if I had known. No, man, not the car. Oh, God, it was beautiful, you know? So if you're new here, don't worry about it. It's eight steps from where you are anyway. So. And it's not eight you have to worry about. It's nine. Nine. Nine's going to really be annoying, but eight's okay. And I did that eight step list, and I started making my amends, and I started doing my job in Alcoholics Anonymous. Around this time, my wife started reaching out to the Al-Anon family groups, and something started happening to me in Alcoholics Anonymous that I found extremely hurtful to me, and I'll just share it with you tonight, because I've been asked to share my story, so what the hell, I'll go ahead and do it. I heard people in Alcoholics Anonymous telling Al-Anon jokes, and I'm not talking about good-natured jokes. God knows we tell enough good-natured jokes about alcoholics and Alcoholics Anonymous. I heard people telling kind of mean, put-down jokes, and I found it tremendously hurtful. My wife was reaching out and finding her own miracle, and I thought it took a tremendous amount of guts. and I was so proud of her. And I would hear some of these jokes. And again, I'm not talking about, you know, the good-natured stuff. That's not what I'm talking about. And I'd say, hold it, man. Isn't this a good thing? Isn't this what we're going after here, the family coming back together? I found it very hurtful and very confusing. And when I hear it done on a public level, then I think the drunk is kind of casting their vote that that's okay. Well, I'm casting my vote that it's not okay. You know? And Nancy really started teaching me a lot about alcoholism. She really started teaching me about the first step. She really started teaching me about being powerless over alcohol. I started learning. I mean, I started coming home and saying, "Well, I don't want to enable this guy that I'm sponsoring." And she go, "Enable? What are you going to do? You make him a drunk with $5 or a drunk without $5? You can't make him not a drunk." You can, you know, and I started going, oh, so it's my $5. I get to choose what to do with the $5. But get the guy, if I could just not give the guy $5 and make him a non-alcoholic, that would be great. You know, it would be a much smaller meeting tonight. We started growing in the program. And I, in my first year of sobriety, I was, you know, working the job kind of my dreams. I was working for a major movie studio, and I started directing situation comedies, and I was making a lot of dough and becoming a spiritual Goliath. Everything was moving along pretty good there, you know. And I was about a year sober. I took my my cake, and I didn't get a sitcom job I wanted, and I almost drank. And my sponsor said, "Well, I guess God is not either. Either everything or he's nothing, and right now he's nothing, pal. You know, because you got a show business God, and I don't think he's going to keep you sober." And I had to really take a look at this, and I had to sit down. And in my AA family, when we do a 10-step, we sit down and write it out the same way we did our inventory. Not that that's good or bad; it's just what we do in our AA family. Different AA families do it kind of different ways. And I had to sit down and write a resentment against myself for almost drinking, against show business for not treating me right. And my sponsor said, "You know, you're going to have to ask God what you're going to have to do to stay sober here." You know. And I said to God at that time, part of my 6 and 7 step was I said, "I'll do anything. Take this. Take show business. Take this too. I'll do anything. Just keep me sober. Please keep me sober. I'm willing to do anything." And within 3 months, I was working as a cook on a catering truck. And I looked up to God and I said, "I didn't mean this. I didn't mean this. We've had a grotesque misunderstanding." In Los Angeles, television and film productions, when they go on location, they have caterers go and they have the caterers in the catering truck feed the cast and crew members their food. And that's a very good paying job. You're in a vehicle on a motion picture set, so it's actually a Teamster's job, and it's a real good dough. And I got a job doing that. And I was doing it, and my first film that I catered, the executive producer and star of the movie was a guy who I had worked with in the business. And that day, he stuck his head on the kitchen truck that morning, and he said, "Can I have a burrito, Scott?" And I said, "What's happening, man?" He said, "Well, is this your truck?" I said, "No, but it's my spatula." man. So I got home and called the sponsor and said, "Yeah, we're getting a miracle now, babe. Yeah, we're getting the gift of Alcoholics Anonymous now." He said, "Sounds like you've got a resentment." And I sat down and I wrote, "I'm resentful at Scott for working on a kitchen truck. It affects my self-esteem, pocketbook, ambition, personal relations, and sex. A 5-bagger for sure." Now, what am I going to ask God to remove? The truck? The guy? The burrito? What am I asking him to take away? What's killing me? Resentment's no big deal. It's just the source of all spiritual illness, the great destroyer of all alcoholics. It'll cut you off from the sunlight of the spirit, take your ass out, and kill you dead. But don't be alarmed. It's no big deal. What am I going to ask God to do? I'm not putzing around here, man. This is life and death. What am I going to ask God to take away? What is blocking me? All right. I'm grandiose. No, don't fight me on this. I'm grandiose. I love saying that to my sponsor. No, Don, don't fight me on this. Never get much of a fight. I'm ungrateful. Guys get sober, they don't get to work. I'm ashamed. I'm jealous. I'm self-centered. Now, selfish, self-centered, and self-seeking are the same, but they're kind of different. This is a disease of self, so it's worth taking a look at, right? Selfish is wanting it all for me. Self-centered is kind of figuring it's all about me. And self-seeking is trying to figure out what's in it for me. So I like being as specific as I can with God when I talk to Him, because what I'm really trying to do is work step three with these steps, right? I'm really trying to do it, give it. And I can't just say, Father, I'm yours. He goes, well, yeah, I knew that. I'm God. I had a feeling you were mine. You're my kid. But thanks, it's a nice gesture. What are you talking about? Well, this is what I'm talking about. Take this. Take this grandiosity. Take this self-centeredness. Take this shame. Take this jealousy. Take this intolerance. Take this impatience. Things aren't moving along at the proper rate. Take this ingratitude. You do that for me, what can I do for you? The biggest question that I've ever asked in Alcoholics Anonymous. Father, what can I do for you? Otherwise, I got them running all over town doing stuff for me, right? And that started my relationship with God. That give and take process. Father, please do my work, I'll do your work. Please take this away so I can draw closer to you and you'll reveal yourself to me. You know, because it became real clear to me that my God wasn't putting me on a kitchen truck and wasn't putting me in a movie studio. My God didn't care what I did for a living. He didn't care if Nancy and I stayed together. He didn't care if I was living in a refrigerator box or on the hill. He expected me to do my job in Alcoholics Anonymous. I came in, I heard people about God getting them parking spaces. I said, no, not the parking God, not the parking God. No, what do you do? What do you do if you don't get a space? I mean, what do? Do you drink? And it became clear to me I had to get a God big enough so that a lot of stuff could happen in His world and I didn't get to blame Him. And my sponsor said something to me I have said to many, many men since, and it's the most beautiful thing to me a man ever said to me. He said, Scott, your God's not big enough for this yet. When you see me in pain, use my God. He's big enough. Use my God until your God gets big enough to take care of this. And He meant it, and I did it. And I leaned on Him, and I used Him. And it was a remarkable thing. And why I went to this man, I don't know. Because my whole life, I went to drowning people and asked for swimming lessons. My whole life, you know. And then when all they said was glub, 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 I'd get pissed off, you know. They're drowning. And this time I didn't. I went to a man in whom my problem had been solved. So I continued doing this, and a little later on, I really started learning how to show up to work and give them a dime for their nickel and be a good member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I started sponsoring other men. I moved on with the steps, and I really became proud of being a good cook. By the time I finished cooking, both the companies I was cooking for asked me to go into business with them. And a couple of years down the line, I was offered a real big writing job, this big public relations company in New York called Ketchum Public Relations. And this really, you know, now I'm really getting spiritual, you know. And this is, you know, now maybe I deserve a pop, you know, right? And it looked real good to me. And I started obsessing on it. I made a videotape for these guys. It was a comedy writing job. And I crashed and burned before I even found out if I had the job. My mind reading skills kicked in. My brain blew up. I went mad. I crashed and burned. I had to sit down and do the 10th step before I even found out about it. I did the 10th step. I called my sponsor. I humbled myself. And I let go of it. I was okay with it. A little while after this, I get a call from Ketchum and they say, you don't have the job. And I was fine with it. Right after that, I hang up the phone and the phone rings and one of the companies I was cooking for said, can you go to Lake Arrowhead, this place near L.A., and cater a commercial? I said, sure. I got in the kitchen truck. I get up there, and I find out that the commercial is for Ketchum Public Relations. I'm feeding them now. Now I'm feeding them. And then a guy comes up to the truck with a video camera, and he's videotaping. And I said, what's that? He said, oh, we're videotaping the making of the commercial. So now they're videotaping my humiliation. And they're going to go back to New York with it, and they're going to show them, and the guys in New York are going to go, is that Scott Redmond with the meatloaf? What? Oh, the poor son of a bitch. You know? Well, I got home, and I called the sponsor, and I said, yeah, the miracle's getting bigger now, pal. We're getting a gift now, good and hard, buddy. And he said to me, I guess God had enough writers and he needed a few cooks today. And then he said to me, well, you know, you told God you wanted to work for Ketchum, you just forgot to tell him what you wanted to do. As long as he's having a good time, folks. In our book, there's a sexual inventory. And in that sexual inventory, we're asked to examine seven things. We're asked to examine where we've been selfish, dishonest, or inconsiderate, unjustifiably aroused, jealousy, suspicion, and bitterness. And then we're asked to do an incredible thing. We're asked to write down, what should we have done instead? This is an incredible thing, because what we're asked basically to do is write about the person we should have been or would like to be. And then in the paragraph right after it, it says, in this way we try to shape a sane, ideal, sound sex life and ask God to help us walk toward it. That's an incredible thing. And at the bottom of the page, it says, the right answers will come if we want them, not if we like them. If we want them. And what has happened for my wife and myself in sobriety is, for me, and the way that I've been taught this program, is I've used that sexual inventory as a template for our relationship. Not just for sex, but for what I do in our relationship. And Nancy and I have we just celebrated 17 years of marriage. We're having a tremendously successful partnership in Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon. And it's been a remarkable thing. And, you know, where have I been selfish? Well, I want what I want when I want it. You know, where have I been dishonest? Well, I might clean the house, and you might think it's because I want a clean house. But no, because in my head, I think there should be a conversion table on the back of cleaning products that a certain amount of housework should equal a certain amount of sex. It's an equation, right? If you do a certain amount of housework, you get a certain amount of sex, and that's just the way it is in this twisted noodle, right? God forbid I should be cleaning the house because, hey, I enjoy living in a clean house. That would be a bizarre thing to do, wouldn't it? Selfish, dishonest, inconsiderate, I don't much care how you feel about it. Where have I unjustifiably aroused jealousy? Well, if you don't do it my way, I might just look at somebody in a way that will be hurtful to you. Suspicion, I might just shut down and just not tell you how I feel and just freeze you out the way I know how to punish you, right? And bitterness, well, that follows. What should I be doing instead? Well, maybe with the help of a sponsor, with the help of this inventory process, with the help of God, maybe I could tell you what I need without telling you what to do. Maybe just because I've told you my feelings, you know, if I tell you my feelings, these are not feelings, these are orders. This is not how I feel, it's what you should do. Well, I had to stop doing that. I had to stop doing that in my marriage. If I could tell you how I feel and it wasn't a set of orders, it didn't mean that you had to then take care of that. Well, that was an incredible thing. And it really, really started working in our house. And our kids really started recovering from alcoholism. I'll give you an idea of how terrified Nancy is of me today. Some months ago, she said to me, you got to take Mike to the dentist. This is our older son. And I said, I have to take him? Where will you be? She said, where will I be? I'll be dancing around the house naked, screaming, I'm not taking him, I'm not taking him. Okay? Is that all right with you? She's terrified. And What's happened to the kids is a pretty remarkable thing. I had a honor of meeting Nancy tonight from Minnesota, who we're going to get to hear tomorrow morning. And I've had some incredible experiences in Alcoholics Anonymous of watching families, watching my family come back to life, and watching people come back to life. Nancy and I have a friend in common who one of the people that goes to one of her home groups. And this is a woman who I knew in Los Angeles, who I visited because she was dead. I mean, she was dead. I went to the hospital, and she was as good as dead. And she's got over a year and a half of sobriety. And the incredible thing for me is I get to hear Nancy describe this woman as an involved member of Alcoholics Anonymous, who she's proud to be associated with, who's taken on a service position. This woman was a useless piece of human sewage, just like me. Just like me, useless. Contact with my children hurt. My kids got sick from prolonged exposure to me. You know. And what has happened because of what you've given me in Alcoholics Anonymous is my kids are getting better and better because of prolonged exposure to me. You know. And it's really an astounding thing. And the boys have met an entire class of adult that's frightened of them. And that's the new men who come to my house. And the boy, when Jesse was about 8, this guy came over, and Jesse walked over to him and said, what step you working, pal? The guy said, four, I'm here to do my fourth. I said, he's 8 years old, man, for God's sake. One of the guys I sponsored, I was telling the boys, this guy got drunk and got into his a pickup and drove 17 miles the wrong way on the freeway and then drove off a 100-foot embankment. And I said to Jess, and he was declared dead at the scene. And Jesse said, yeah, and dumb. This guy came over, this is some months ago, this guy came over to, he had started his fifth step on a Wednesday, and he came over to finish it on Thursday. And Jesse was doing his homework, and without even looking up, the guy walked in and Jess went, what's the matter, dude? Blew it last night, got to do it again. Alcoholics Anonymous, that's what's happened in our family. And my family has had the opportunity to pass on family recovery to a bunch of people, and it's been a remarkable thing. Some months ago, we found out our 15-year-old son had begun experimenting with drugs. And I didn't even want to share about it. I didn't even want to deal with it. You know. And my wife, once again, taught me something about alcoholism. She started sharing about it at meetings. I said, well, what are you doing that for? And she said, Scott, I'm in Al-Anon. Hello? Hello? That's what we do. We share about surviving alcoholism. I don't know if my kid's an alcoholic or not, but that's what's going on. And I had to start sharing about it in meetings because it was only through you guys getting to podiums and share and telling me that whether or not my kid uses drugs or alcohol has nothing to do with whether it doesn't mean I'm working a bad program. Whether or not I'm working a good or bad program, I am powerless over alcoholism. Why am I asked to work with other drunks? Because there's no greater assurance against immunity from drink than intensive work with other drunks. You know, there's nothing like a new man. Nothing that'll show you how powerless you are over alcoholism. A couple of months ago, I met a guy at a meeting. He calls me up. He's 14 days sober. He gets on the phone with me, talks for an hour. I say, four times so he knows I'm not dead. Right? Just so he knows the paramedics haven't carted me away. I'm listening, and he's telling me how 2 weeks ago he was stalking a couple of women. He had a restraining order taken out against him, but it's different now. He's 2 weeks sober. And at the end of the conversation, he says, I feel so alone. I said, well, I hardly know you, and I listened to you for an hour without interrupting you. He said, I don't have a woman. I said, well, what would you be bringing right now to a relationship besides stalking skills? What will you be bringing to the party right now? What a terrible thing it is that you don't have a woman. My wife's walking through our bedroom one day, and I'm on the phone with the new guy, and all she hears me saying to the phone is, okay, let's say the aliens are coming. I'm not going to argue about if they're cut. That's an outside interest. I just have one question, pal. Why are they coming for you? You're a day and a half sober. You have no life. Why have they traversed a universe for you? Don't you think they'll look up the president or something? And he's sleeping with a Bible on his forehead because they're going to call through all this stuff, come into his room and go, oh, no, the Bible's on his forehead. And they're gonna dash out of the room. If you're new here and you have a plan, don't use the plan. Please. Oh, man. A month ago, on January 17th at 4:31 a.m., I was woken up by a powerful, powerful earthquake. We live right near the epicenter in Sherman Oaks, and I did think we were going to die. I thought myself, Nancy, my beautiful wife, and my two beautiful sons were going to die. And we held on to each other, and I can't describe it. I can't describe the experience. I just tell you that if everything in your house poured out of every cupboard, if the refrigerator doors opened up and everything came out, if the windows cracked, if the walls moved, if you heard stuff coming down all around you, 40% of the buildings on our block are condemned. I thought we were going to die. I said my prayer, holy shit. I got spiritual much later in the day. We waited till it stopped. We got dressed and we started. We walked a couple of blocks away where a man who I sponsor lives with his wife and their five-month-old baby. Their place was totally destroyed. They were on the street. We told them they'd be staying with us. We got them over to our house. Then we walked to my sponsor's house a couple of blocks away. And his place was totally destroyed. A man had just died in his arms. He had been electrocuted, and Don had given him mouth-to-mouth resuscitation, and the guy died. And then it started. Then you started. Then Alcoholics Anonymous started. It started that day, a couple hours after the quake. Swarms of drunks started appearing at these apartments and evacuating people and moving them into storage. Everybody started hooking everybody else up, where they were going to live, who had babies, who needed more room, what was going to happen. The family of Alcoholics Anonymous, I want to tell you, it's unbelievable. It's what I wanted my whole life. My entire life, this is what I wanted. One place, this swarm of drunks, 15, like drunken locusts, 20 guys from my AA family descend on this apartment. And there's people devastated all around. They don't know what to do. And this woman says to me, how do you get them? How do you get them? And I said, well, you have to almost die. vomit a lot. And maybe we'll come over later on. I don't know. It was astounding. And one of the men I sponsor, his wife, has just kind of been sitting on the fence about this deal. She just was standing there, and she saw the demonstration of Alcoholics Anonymous. Not the chin music, not the talk, the demonstration of Alcoholics Anonymous, the enthusiastic demonstration. And she said to me, they're not even screwing around. I said, no, hey, they've screwed around. They've already screwed around. They're not here to screw around. They're done, you know? And this woman, and I saw it in her eyes. 2 months before, she had been in my house. One of the men I sponsor is from another country, and his wife is from another country. They're having a baby. We had a baby shower for them because their families aren't here. 40 members of Alcoholics Anonymous and the Al-Anon family group showed up with beautifully wrapped gifts, looking beautiful, you know, dressed beautifully. And they came over to our house, and I said, you don't understand. When you were at that shower, you don't understand something. The people at the shower don't know them. There were 40 people there. Only 5 of them knew those people. She said, get out of here. I said, no, you don't get it. This is what we've got. This is what's going on in Alcoholics Anonymous. If you're new here, you can be as alone as you want here. You can be alone as you want here, or you can be one of the alcoholic locusts. You can jump on board, man, and become part of this deal because it's what I want. It's what I want in my life. It's what I want around me. If you're new here, I do want to tell you that this is the only text which is a book about treatment from a fatal illness that contains the sentence, "We absolutely insist on enjoying life." There is no book about a fatal illness that has... There's no book about cholera that says, "Cholera is a scream." You'll love cholera. It's a hoot. You'll meet people, other people with cholera. You'll have a fabulous time with them. And then you'll meet people who just caught cholera. It doesn't get any better than that, you know? If you're new here, I just want to suggest that you stick around long enough to get a diagnosis. If you've been drinking at exactly the wrong time, if you build up a bright outlook for yourself and your family and rip it down around your ears in a senseless series of sprees, if you fail to recall with sufficient force the memory of the pain and humiliation of a day, a week, a second ago, you could be an alcoholic. If you're not, what is wrong with you? Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. Welcome home. Thanks for having me down tonight.